You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Hartman today. On today's show, Tyson Slocum, Director of Public Citizens Energy Program, is going to join us to talk about why the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is pushing so hard to frack everywhere. Former GOP operative Mike Lagerin is going to talk about his new book, The Party's Over. And the Roosevelt Institute's Bryce Covert is going to talk about his attack, the attack, I mean ongoing, endless attack on unemployment benefits. And on the phone, of course, I have Cliff Schechter, best-selling author and just all-around columnist on anything that's happening today in politics. You know, Thomas Jefferson said, I believe, this is his quote, he said, I believe that the banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies. 63 years later, Abraham Lincoln expanded that warning. Here's what Lincoln said. He said, I have two great enemies, the Southern Army in front of me and the financial institutions at my rear. Of the two, he said, the one behind me is the greatest enemy. I feel at this moment more anxiety for the safety of my country than ever before in the midst of war. And he was talking about the banking industry. Thomas Jefferson and Lincoln said the same things. Both of those presidents saw the same arrogance from bankers that Obama saw when he suggested that banking industry leaders should meet with him and discuss their criminal caliber conduct that they had exhibited for decades. Remember that? He called a meeting because the conduct was so outrageous. The Citigroup CEO actually sent a message to President Obama and said he had other things to do, that he didn't have time to personally meet with the president. One thing is clear, the bankers who did clear their schedule to meet with President Obama didn't take the power of the presidency any more seriously today than the bankers did when Lincoln called them America's greatest enemy. When Jefferson told us that the banking institutions would be more dangerous than standing armies, he had no way of foreseeing the truth. He had no way of foreseeing TARP, the TARP treachery that bankers pulled off with more $800 billion, more than $800 billion in taxpayer money paid out in that scam. But in 2008, Obama saw the beginning of that treachery for the first time, maybe. I don't know. When he watched America's most powerful bankers grovel like pathetic paupers begging for handouts. They'd been piggish, incompetent, sociopathic failures. They couldn't even do their job, and now they needed welfare tax money from you and me. In fact, the Citigroup bankers who couldn't clear their schedule to meet with Obama in that first meeting in 2009, well, they were part of that groveling group. Citigroup received $20 billion in TARP groveling welfare. Not only was Citigroup too busy to meet personally with the president, they also never met with all the small businesses that they promised loans to. Remember that? You see, they were promising to invest in our economy. But today, as we speak, they're sitting on almost $4 trillion of money that they haven't lent in hopes of harming Obama's economy in this upcoming election. Citigroup is not the only beggar who lied to taxpayers in order to get handouts. All of those Wall Street panhandlers told taxpayers that they were going to agree to new banking regulations to control their obscene greed when they wanted welfare. A few of them had admitted, they even came out and said it was the lack of regulations that burned the house down. But the day after they said that, the day after they got their hands on that money, they hired hundreds of rapacious K Street lobbyists to undermine banking reform legislation. And that continues today. They're still trying to go back on their promise. The shorthand to explaining all that is that you can put a $4,000 suit on a thief, but he or she is still going to be a thief, even dressed up in that suit. Once again, the banking industry validated a warning Jefferson left us late in his career. And he said this. This is a quote from Jefferson. If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, the banks and corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless. Thomas Jefferson said that in 1802. Does it sound familiar? Does it sound like maybe he was right? How could Jefferson have been such a prophet? Well, he knew that the people have never really mattered. Real people never really mattered at all to the silk suits that are now America's new money changers in the temple. He also understood the insane love of money and profit in the banking industry, and he knew that it was always going to trump decency and humanity and community and democracy. The Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, Barclays, J.P. Morgan crowd that for decades have hustled money away from mom-and-pop pension programs with a new dishonest scam virtually every month, they need to be perp-walked in prison garb before we're ever going to gain control over to capitalism again. There's simply no other route. It's difficult to move a feeding pig away from a trough of limitless food. They'll eat themselves to death. They will die at the trough. It would take two generations of reform to ever get rid of Wall Street greed. But you know what? 100 or so 10-year prison sentences, it would work wonders, Mr. President. After the Wall Street banking thugs crashed capitalism 1929 and brought us the Great Depression, Sing Sing, Alcatraz, and every major prison in America was filled with banker CEOs and cheap Wall Street hustlers who look exactly like the cheap banking Wall Street hustlers of 2012. But FDR actually had a Justice Department that wasn't fearful of doing their job. We actually had a true-to-life attorney general. And that helped save capitalism. It helped save democracy. Hell, even the Reagan administration prosecuted 800 banking swindlers after the S&L crisis. Bankers actually went to prison because they were criminals. And we had to admit they're criminals. So you know what's startling about this story? President Obama and our Attorney General Eric Holder have indicted or prosecuted a whopping zero Wall Street bank criminals who've stolen $18 trillion from us just the last time. Just the last big scam is when they did that. Even the repeat recidivist criminals understand that they're under no threat of prosecution with this Attorney General Eric Holder. Barclays, LIBOR threat, they pay $450 million, no one's in handcuffs, multi-trillions were scammed. Citigroup, Goldman, J.P. Morgan, J.P. Morgan Chase, they pay $180 million for outright fraud and theft and stealing and no perp walk. But let a person by the name of maybe Devon Williams or Alicia Johnson, let them sell less than 2 ounces of pot, and the feds will hold a damn press conference touting that they sent these people to prison and America is now safe. The Cosa Nostra Mafia, the Devon Williams, the Alicia Johnsons, they're not the ones who are doing the most damage to this democracy. It's the guys in Rolex watches who occupy Wall Street that are the clearest and most present danger. We're going to talk about it today. I'm Mike Papantonio. Mr. Holder, even if the showboat press conferences about how you're fighting your war on drugs or how you have the mafia on the run, you know as well as I do that those are not the real criminals in America. Those are not the dangerous criminals we need to be aware of. Give me a call at 866-987-8466. I'll be back with Cliff Schechter. Stay tuned.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm Mike Papantonio, sitting in for Tom. Give me a call, 866-987-8466. We'll be right back.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher, and it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Show. Love that Johnny Cash. Standing in for Tom Hartman today. I'm Mike Papantonio. I have Cliff Schechter with me. Cliff, as many of you probably know, is a political columnist and a best-selling author. Talks and writes about issues like this bankster gone crazy issue just about every day. Cliff, what would you add?
Well, I would add that obviously you nailed that 100% correctly, that it's kind of interesting that somehow we've gotten to thinking of the conservative, quote, you know, put that in quotes, position, you know, which usually is the traditional position, is that corporations should be able to run rampant over everyone and there should be absolutely no regulation, and as if this was the way it was from the beginning of time. Whereas the truth of the matter is that a lot of what the founders were, you know, founding fathers were rebelling against was the East India Tea Company, right? The East India Company controlled all the tea imports.
Right.
They were busy ripping us off. I mean, they knew the dangers of corporations and of money from the very beginning. The reason why they eventually didn't put the U.S. Capitol in New York is they didn't want the political capital to be so close to where the financial capital was.
To where the corruption was.
As you point out again and again in your opening, these dangers. And somehow we've forgotten that now, you know, even when you think of post-depression, everything we learned, we undid in the 90s and 2000s. And, if these guys are not, if we don't put these guys in prison, if we don't make anyone pay, you're exactly right. You know, what's the disincentive from these guys just doing it again and again?
You know what, Cliff, it would be I'm not exaggerating. It would be two complete generations of regulatory reform just to get even close to anything meaningful, because you have to re-educate the MBAs coming out of school. Right now, they don't teach the kind of courses that really have an impact on a CEO, where the CEO understands, look, greed will destroy capitalism. Unfettered greed will destroy the system to where your children and their grandchildren, they don't have anything left. And, you know, after being a prosecutor, one thing I do know, throw them in jail, throw 100 in jail this year, throw 25 in jail next year, and before you know it, the system takes care of itself. That's why we have that system in America, where we can throw criminals in prison. That's the only solution here. I'd love to say that that Dodd-Frank is going to solve it, or if we bring back Glass-Steagall, it's going to solve it. You had Glass-Steagall for so long. FDR understood that you had to have something like Glass-Steagall. But he also understood that he was not afraid to throw a Wall Streeter in Sing Sing simply because the Wall Streeter dressed up in a three-piece suit, had a Rolex watch, and maybe went to his country club. He was still a criminal. And what we've done is we've conditioned our mind to see these criminals show up on television. And, you know, they have a lot of money. Gee, they're really wealthy, so they must be smart. They were the CEO of a corporation, so they must be ethical. They have a good education, therefore their opinion must be important. And we simply ignore their track record. We ignore everything that they're about. And it's because of this, it's this cultural strain that just we can't let go of. We're conditioned to think like that. And until dress them up differently.
TV, you know, when you watch things. I remember during, I think it was Bowling for Columbine, Michael Moore kind of put together a parody of what the show Cops would look like if they were throwing white-collar criminals in prison. Because it's always, you know, it seems like it's always, first of all, more racial, and it's African-Americans. It's guys without shirts or in their undershirts or whatever. It's not these guys in these three-piece suits who, as you're right, called FDR a traitor to his race because he actually decided to take them on.
Yeah, but you'll have an attorney general, I mean, like Holder. Holder throws a press conference. He shows you, well, we got a bunch of drugs here, or we've got the Casa Nostra in handcuffs. And he understands. The damn Casa Nostra is not the threat to democracy. The kid that's selling 3 ounces of pot that can go to prison under the federal guidelines for 5 years, they're not the problem. It's Wall Street. And when in the hell are we going to react and say, you know, Mr. President, we like you. We like what you've done here, President Obama. We like most of what you've done. But you have lied to us. Because if you remember, when all this started, President Obama said, I'm going to get this straightened out. And he's done anything but that. He surrounded himself with the same very thieves that we're talking about here. He surrounded himself with the very people that I'm talking about, the Goldman Sachs people. The J.P. Morgan people, those are his advisors. He's not throwing them in prison. Hell, he's having drinks with them. So until we can start thinking differently about the way somebody looks, you know, they look like they've got white sideburns. They dress nice. They've got nice shoes. Well, you know, they must not be a criminal. Hell, a man with a briefcase, Cliff, can steal 100,000 times more than a man with a gun.
Isn't that true?
And that's what we've proven in this country. And what do you think it's going to take to get this administration? I hope we're going to have them for four more years. Do you think they're going to change?
I don't know. You know, there's a theories out there. Will they have the courage to do it in a second term, or they're not worried about reelection and Wall Street money? I hope so. You know, I mean, there are cases in the past. You know, I mean, John F. Kennedy turned on the mob, and Harry Truman turned on some of the guys, the machine that helped get him elected. I mean, you know, and FDR, as we just talked about, there are guys who do the right thing at some point. I hope Obama does. But, you know, if I were to tell you I was, you know, sanguine about it after what we've seen, I would be lying to you.
Cliff, it is a vital problem. It is the democracy will crumble if we don't get Wall Street under control. You know that. I knew that.
Absolutely.
Jefferson knows that, knew that. Lincoln knew that. I mean, when you say I've got the South in front of me, I got bankers to the back, but I'm worried about the guys in back of me, that's a pretty strong statement. I'm Mike Papantonio, standing in for Tom Hartman, 866-987-8466. Give me a call.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'm Mike Papantonio. When I come back, Tyson Slocum talking about fracking gone crazy in America. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Mike Papantonio, standing in for Tom. You know, I got to tell you, right now, fracking is something that we've heard about. Most people at least know what it is, but we have no idea. Most people have no idea, A, how dangerous it is, not to just the environment, but to people living around the environment. The other thing we don't realize is how in control of the regulators and the regulations the fracking industry is. There are no regulations. There is no oversight. And the money that's going in to maintain that status quo is overwhelming. I have Tyson Slocum with me today to talk about it. Tyson is with the Public Citizens Energy Program. He's director of that. Tyson, you followed this a long time. It doesn't seem to be getting any better if I watch this fracking story unfold.
That's right. You have to remember that it really starts with the signature energy law of the Bush administration, the 2005 Energy Policy Act. That bill was, you know, 1,400 pages long, but buried in that 1,400-page long bill was two sentences that granted a special exemption from compliance with federal clean water laws.
Yeah, that was the Dick Cheney. That was the Dick Cheney law. That behind closed doors, he met with the energy industry. As a matter of fact, I happen to know something about that because Bobby Kennedy and I tried to get the records of what was actually happening. And then, of course, you had Antonin Scalia, who went duck hunting with the vice president, and then within a couple of weeks, rules that we can't have those records. So
yeah,
I'm very familiar with those closed door meetings.
It was actually our attorneys here at Public Citizen that argued that case before the Supreme Court on behalf of a number of environmental groups mm-hmm. in an effort to get the court to force Cheney to turn over those documents. And as you said, the court ruled against us. But that law specifically exempted hydraulic fracturing from having to comply with federal drinking water laws. Now, there's a number of states that have enacted their own statutes, but we're looking at a real patchwork of regulation. Some states are doing a better job than others, but the fact is that a lot of problems are coming up to the surface.
Well, let me, no pun intended here, but let me drill down and talk about what I know. I know, for example, it's overwhelming. The data is overwhelming that this fracking is affecting aquifers where people get their drinking water. We know for sure that the chemicals that are moving into those aquifers, even though the fracking industry is trying to keep them quiet, we're finding out more and more about what's in it. And it's carcinogen. It's chemicals that will cause leukemia and all types of cancers. We also know that it's increasing the earthquakes. No question. This is not even up for debate anymore, that fracking is actually increasing earthquakes. But even with all that, Tyson, you have there is no regulatory agency that's watching any of this, is there?
That's right. There are some aspects of fracking that are coming under EPA jurisdiction, but not the primary issue, which is the injection of at least 6 to 8 million gallons of chemically treated water mixed up with sand that's injected for each well. And
right.
There are tens of thousands of these wells, sometimes within a single county. And there are no regulations about what happens when that chemically treated water is injected into the earth, when a small amount of that chemical treatment comes back up to the surface and what they have to do to treat it. There are no regulations concerning doing seismic surveys prior to fracking. And so,
Tyson, but to me, it's worse than that. I mean, that's bad. But you even have the industry that has such control of what's going on here to where I know this story. They're going and they're getting land leases.
Mm-hmm.
Then they're going onto the land and they're fracking on somebody's private property. Then the people living on the private property are becoming ill. They actually have people in their family that are becoming sick. They're relating it to the fracking. And then the fracking industry settles with the people. And then the people can't disclose what happened. The people
that
are affected.
There's non-disclosure agreements. And you're absolutely right. And so what happens is these people get sick. They're desperate for money. And so the industry says, okay, we acknowledge that we made you sick. Here's money. But the only way for you to accept this money is if you sign a gag order where you cannot talk or disclose about anything related to this event. And then the fracking industry turns around and says, oh, there's no evidence whatsoever of people getting sick. Show us the people.
How about
talk on record? And it's because they've been silenced through these gag orders.
Tyson, how about this? How about the doctor who wants to treat a cancer cluster? That's affecting maybe a case we're looking at right now on an Indian reservation where you have people that you have an entire cluster of people being affected in the same way. Doctor wants to know what in the hell is – what do you have in there? What is the chemical
right.
that you have that you're – we know you're using diesel fuel and we know you're putting it down into the aquifer. But we want to know what other chemicals are in there because we're seeing people that are getting clusters of unusual cancers. And do you realize the government and judges are not even permitting under those circumstances a disclosure of what the fracking industry is using?
Right. It just shows you how completely out of balance our system of laws and regulation has gotten. And what's even crazier is that Mitt Romney goes on the campaign speech yesterday and says, we need to produce more fossil fuels here in America. Well, I don't think that he's been reading what's going on. 5 months ago, the United States passed Russia as the largest natural gas producer on the planet.
Right.
And together with our coal and our oil production, all combined, we are the largest fossil fuel producer, and all of
that happened under
the Obama administration.
Yeah, we're exporting it. Look, let's go down the list. The Safe Water Drinking Act. Do the fracking industry, do they have to comply?
They do not.
The Clean Air Act, does the fracking industry have to comply?
There's elements of the Clean Air Act under rules proposed by the EPA in April that would require the industry to start to trap at least 25% of the methane emissions that are coming out of the well. But as of right now, no, it is not being regulated.
There's a
proposal to regulate.
Right, exactly. And also the Clean Water Act, the same story here.
No regulation.
No regulation. There's no other industry I can even point to that gets away with what we're talking about. But here you had this evil little guy that back then, I think he had a human heart back then, but then he went from human heart to artificial heart. Now he has a human heart again. Dick Cheney. He knew exactly what was going to happen, and Dick Cheney understood well enough to understand. We knew enough about fracking to know even then how dangerous it was to human health. We knew then. Even with guesswork, even reading the tea leaves on the chemicals, we knew how dangerous it was.
Oh, yeah, because fracking has been around for a while.
Right.
What that 2005 law gave the industry was a huge pass,
right,
so that it didn't have to worry about complying with all of these public health laws. And so that's what really helped the industry vastly expand its fracking operations, particularly in areas of the country like Pennsylvania, where there wasn't any sort of oil and gas drilling to the extent that we're seeing today.
The numbers, the last numbers I saw, it was somewhere approaching 2,000 wells a month that are being drilled. Is that still current information?
I think it actually might be higher than that.
Yeah.
The only thing right now that's keeping more drilling activity off the table is the fact that natural gas prices remain very low, just over $3. And so that's where the pressure to significantly expand our ability to export natural gas.
Right.
And we think that that's a huge problem.
Yeah. Tell me, how has I think I know the answer, but how have the Koch brothers and the frackers gotten the teabaggers to turn out for this one? I noticed there was a pro-fracking get together that took place up around northern Broome County, and they actually had the teabaggers out. They had their industry out. They were talking about how great fracking was. How have they gotten the teabaggers involved here?
Well, because it fits into this narrative that the Tea Party likes to say that Obama has wasted taxpayer dollars on renewable energy investments while actively trying to block fossil fuel development. And obviously, it's a complete fabrication. Like I said, we, under Obama's watch, have become the largest fossil fuel producer in the world, and we are the single largest natural gas producer on the planet. And in fact, we are producing so much natural gas through fracking that in quarterly financial results posted by Shell and some of the other big oil and gas companies, they said that low natural gas prices in North America are reducing their profit margins.
Mm.
And so they are producing
Tyson
so much that they're actually not making as much money.
Thank you, my friend. Thanks for joining me. I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Hartman. Give me a call, 866-987-8466. When we come back, I'll go to some of these calls. Or follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. I'd like to know what you're thinking about. I'm Mike Papantonio. I'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Hartman today. Give me a call at 866-987-8466. We'll talk about what you have on your mind.
Cause there's only so much oil in the ground. Sooner or later there won't be none around. Alternate sources of power must be found. Cause there's only so much oil.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Hartman. Let's go to some of these callers. Mike in Brooklyn, are you there?
Yes, Mike. I'm so glad you took my call. Look, the first thing I had to ask you, when you started out today, I had to ask you, did you have gunpowder for breakfast? Because you are sure lit up.
It's what I do for a living, Mike. I do it in the courtroom, and I do it hopefully on radio and television. That's just who I am. I know sometimes it's a little bit too much jazz, but it's the truth. It's what I feel.
No. The truth is the truth. But look, I've got a bunch of things I want to ask you. So let me lay them out there. And going back to one of the previous callers, the first question I had was, how much of this administration's lack of action is based on their inability to appoint federal judges? That goes back to the Senate and the House not allowing Obama to get his appointees in. But the other thing was, could or should Eric Holder have taken a preemptive action in knowing that the Republicans were going to do Jim Crow, trying to restrict voting?
Yes, very good questions. The first question has to do with judges' appointments. It's not just that there haven't been enough judges appointed. That's part of it. The other part of it is the judges who have been appointed, you may as well gone to corporate America and said, pick out the people that you want to serve and to review your case when your case comes before us. These judges are horrible. They're horrible. It's no exaggeration to say the statistics have been done. I've seen the studies two or three different ways. 73% of the judiciary at the trial level, federal trial level, are considered conservative Republican. Okay? 74% at the appellate level are considered conservative Republican. Now, the reason that's important is because when a corporate thug is in front of a conservative Republican judge, understand, most of the time that judge has come from a corporate defense background, like Eric Holder. Eric Holder came from a firm called Covington Burling in Washington, D.C. They make their money. The people they represent are white-collar criminals. They're people who destroy our environment. They're people who every day on Wall Street steal money from mom-and-pop pension programs. They are the very people that are always caught and always judged. So that's the second part of the judge story. It's not that there just haven't been enough judges appointed. It is that Obama has allowed the appointments, they're disastrous. They are. I am not exaggerating, Mike. I appear in front of judges all the time. They're disastrous. They don't come from an area where they represented consumers. These aren't judges that have anything in common with the working man. These are judges that come from corporate defense firms, silk stocking defense firms in places like Washington, New York, L.A., and they don't have anything in common with working people. They have everything in common with corporate America. So that's the first, that really is one of the biggest, really the biggest parts of the problem. Let me get to this next caller, though. Willie in Philadelphia. How are you, Willie?
Hey, Mike, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Yeah, Mike, yeah, Paul Tagliabue was a part of that law firm, too, Covington and Burley, former NFL commissioner.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, Mike, here's the deal. These people out here, they don't realize what is at stake in this election. The stakes are so high, and the Tea Party are just playing a role that the Koch brothers are driving. The Koch brothers are funding all of this, and people don't get the picture. They out here voting against their best interests. I talk to people at work. They're like, oh, the Obama, this. So I said, look, you don't make as much as I do. Do you think when these people get in office, if they should win, God forbid, all of us are in trouble. They're not just looking at me. They're looking at you as well. They are here to roll this country back like it's never been before. In 1913, the Federal Reserve Bank was created, the ADL and the FBI. All that was created so that would be smoke screens. You couldn't speak bad against the Jewish people because the ADL would get on you. The FBI was out to make people look bad. So all this was just planned. Now it's all coming into fruition, and people need to realize that the Koch brothers are driving all this. You wake up one morning, you'll have a landmine dumped beside your home and all by all the schools, and nothing you can do. I don't understand why these people are so hateful. What do they want?
Well, one thing you have to understand, you got to understand this, Willie. First of all, Heritage Foundation, Heartland, Cato, Freedom Works, U.S. Chamber of Commerce, They have spent a lot of money trying to get into the mind of, if you look at the numbers right now, you still have blue-collar workers, people who have nothing in common with the Koch brothers, have nothing in common with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, nothing in common with Heritage or all these billionaire inheritance babies. They have nothing in common with them. But they feel like they have kinship with them. And these foundations have done a lot of money. They spent a lot of money, a lot of effort trying to focus on how do they get into their head. So right now, last numbers I think is like 54% of blue-collar workers, if you can imagine, male blue-collar workers favor Mitt Romney. Now, for what? What has he given them that is in any that they, he has? This is, he wouldn't let them in to the back door of this garage. Wouldn't let them in the back door. But these are people who feel like they have a kinship with a billionaire. Some, and it's complicated, but here's the parts of it. First of all, they've played off on the idea that you have an African-American president, and you like it or not, race is an issue. The second part of it is they've been sold this idea of what they call the Horatio Alger myth, and that they can relate to a billionaire because someday they may be a billionaire. Someday their child may be a billionaire. So it's perfectly makes perfect sense that you shouldn't have an inheritance tax or that you shouldn't make a billionaire pay more taxes, because in their mind, in this Horatio Alger plan, they're somehow going to be a billionaire, too. It's very complicated. There are many more parts we'll talk about as the show continues. I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Hartman, 866-987-8466. I'll be right back.
Listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Hartman. My next guest, Mike Lofgren, is the author of a new book, The Party's Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And it comes from an interesting perspective. Mike was a Republican congressional staffer for years, left the party, saw some of the same changes that many people who've left the party have seen over the last decade. Mike, you know, we talk about this concept of how dangerous it is to mix religion with politics all the time. Some people hear it and understand it. Most people don't. The 10,000 foot of why it just doesn't work.
Well, and this is not a criticism of religion. What this is saying is if you mix politics with religion, you're going to debase both. And when you do that, now, you know, I really didn't see this coming. Religious cranks were only a minor public nuisance in this country in the 1970s, but they became a major element in the Republican rank and file, and that started with Pat Robertson's strong showing in the 88 Iowa presidential caucus.
Pat Robertson didn't start it. It was started by Republican operatives who understood the power of shifting the South. And part of the element of shifting the South was to use the pulpit, was to get the Southern Baptists and evangelicals upset at Democrats to where they had nothing in common. The Democrat was the ungodly horde that wanted to subjugate Christianity. Isn't that kind of...
Well, that's partly true. It was kind of a symbiotic process,
right,
with some of the fundamentalists like Jerry Falwell moving towards the Republican Party and Republicans moving towards the religious right. Now, I didn't see that coming, although I must say it struck me as rather humorous. This must have been about 88 or 90. A fundamentalist staff member in my congressional office was going to take time off to convert the heathen in Greece, which, you know, has been an overwhelmingly Christian country for about 2,000 years.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I guess there were other elements that were stirring in the party that were different from mine.
You know, a topic you talk about, and of course, I've heard the term cheap grace for a long time also. Cheap grace is one of the reasons in the, I think both parties, but more so in the Republican Party, certainly in the last decade, is the reason that a guy like David Vitter can be the number one choice on a madam's list in Washington, D.C., and have this long history of having relationships with prostitutes, and then go back to Louisiana and be elected senator because of cheap grace.
Newt Gingrich can have a role in the upcoming convention.
Right. Explain what cheap grace is. It certainly is an interesting concept. It's an evangelical concept, isn't it?
Well, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was an evangelical minister, a German, who was killed by the Nazis.
Right.
He had lived a portion of his life in the early 1930s in America, and he had seen all the evangelical fervor and the fundamentalist Bible thumping, and he derided that as cheap grace. It's kind of a get-out-of-hell-free card that once you say that Jesus has saved me, not only does it wipe away your past sins, it wipes away any future sins.
And that's even without, it's even without incremental confessions, isn't it? I mean, in other words, cheap grace says you've been baptized, therefore you have a place in heaven no matter what your conduct is. And the reason that, to me, that's an important issue is because every time we see another Republican politician, I remember Ted Haggard. I mean, you know, here was Ted Haggard, had 30 million people following him all the time. And
right.
Ted Haggard was regarded as this truly religious, spiritual leader. And then we find
the Bush administration hung on his advice.
Exactly.
Part of their inner circle.
He used to brag that he would have a conversation with the White House weekly and tell them what they ought to be doing. And then we find out that he was having a relationship with a male hooker along with coke and every other kind of drug they could possibly find inside the apartment, according to the story. And we find out that this life that he's described to us as being that spiritual leader is far from reality. But nevertheless, the community to this day still forgives him because of cheap grace, right?
Well, we're all fallen angels, but
right.
I guess we need to set aside our own self-righteousness.
Well, that was the problem.
A lot of us have not.
that's the problem is, it's one thing for somebody to live that life, but it's another thing when you live that life and at the same time, out of the other side of your mouth, you're telling people how they should live their lives.
And condemning others,
you know, hell and damnation for everybody. Well, your book is a moving book in the sense that what you talk about is really the destruction of the Republican Party. It no longer is a Republican Party. It's not even recognizable as a Goldwater or Eisenhower Party, is it?
Well, it's no longer conservative because it doesn't believe in conserving anything. It does not believe in prudence, caution, and governance, which is what I believe a true conservative like Eisenhower would do.
I see, you know, I saw today in the New York Times, as a matter of fact, they're talking about how the young Republicans that are moving through the ranks are trying to distance themselves from this crazy religious right that seems to be capturing the party. They want to distance themselves from cultural issues that they think no longer make them relevant. I think, the number of young Republicans, I mean, it's almost an oxymoron. It's almost a joke. I remember being at University of Florida where, you know, even back then, the college young Republican was kind of an oddity. But now it's even more of an oddity, and you have the young Republicans that are saying, we think we understand the problem, that people don't want to be preached to by frauds. They don't want to be told how to live their life when the fraud telling them how to live their life is doing just the opposite of what they're saying. So I think there is an attempt to maybe restructure that with the Republican Party, but it's going to take a lot of work, isn't it?
It will take a lot of work, and it will take a lot of time. I guess they kind of have to hit bottom before they come to their senses.
Have they hit bottom?
These things just do not work themselves out until people reach a crisis.
They thought they had achieved
something in 2010, and they did. So they believe they're going to play the same, you know, game plan in 2012, and I'm not going to take a bet on who's going to win.
Yeah, Ralph Reed is out there in full tilt, isn't he?
They're all out there.
Well, here you have, this is the best example I can give. Ralph Reed, really, if you take a look at his connection to Jack Abramoff, it's real questionable to begin with. The Tom DeLay, Ralph Reed, Jack Abramoff, Grover Norquist connection about what they did with as lobbyists with the Indian casinos. Some people went to jail, some didn't. And you have to wonder, that hasn't fazed him, has he? He's certainly in leadership of the Republican Party. They're afraid of Ralph Reed, aren't they, still?
Pretty much. And I would add that Tom DeLay, Abramoff, and all those folks were in on that business of suppressing news of labor violations in the Northern Marianas territories, mm-hmm. which are an American from the point of view of trade, everything they produce is considered made in USA.
Yeah, this
and
doesn't...
They had virtual gulag conditions
right.
in the 1990s, and there were even reports of forced abortions.
Mike, I got to go. Thank you for joining me. 866-987-8466. I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Hartman. I'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Hartman. Give me a call at 866-987-8466. We'll be right back.
Turn out the lights. The party's over. They say that all...
Welcome back to Tom Hartman Program. I'm Mike Papantonio sitting in for Tom. Let's go to some of these callers. Let's go to Chris in Bellevue. Chris, are you there?
I am here.
Go ahead.
How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Hey, it's good to meet you when you came here to Seattle. You're a great guy.
Yeah, hey, it was a great program.
I want to comment on what you guys talked about earlier. There actually was a Wall Street banker who did not only get prosecuted but convicted. And the reason he did was because he broke the cardinal rule, and he stole from the 1%, and that was Bernie Madoff. And he's sitting in jail right now, and he's the only one, because he went after the rich guys, the guys you're not supposed to. All the rest of us, it's okay to do it too.
You know, the problem, you're right, Chris. I mean, as a matter of fact, it's interesting you said that, because when it happened, that was one of my comments that, yeah, he's going to go to jail because he stole from his other rich pals. But
The wrong people.
The problem is that until we'd like to think that from regulations we can change the nature of Wall Street and the banking corruption. There was a time maybe when we could, but we've passed that. And if you can't regulate this away. You can't regulate the frenzy, the feeding frenzy that's taken place on Wall Street in the banking industry away. You can try for two generations. And you can't do it. But you can throw people in prison, and you can do what FDR did. You know what FDR understood? And is to oddly enough, to Ronald Reagan's credit, even Ronald Reagan, when he threw in 600, I think he had, God, I think it was 600 indictments, 800 bankers or so thrown in jail for the S&L crisis. Out of that, and you had very conservative politicians, I mean, that were running the show, and they said, if we don't do this, capitalism is at risk. For some reason, and FDR said the same thing, after the burn down in 1929 and the Great Depression, he understood that you can't regulate this away, that you have to punish them to where it hurts. Now, what we have now is a LIBOR, we have the LIBOR scam. That's on us right now. Now, I read, yeah, indictments are going out. People are, you know, the investigators are being sent. Statements are being taken. But you watch. Let's count. You'll be able to count on one hand the people that are really affected by this. And the problem is democracy can't work. Now, capitalism is not a bad system when it works properly, but it can't work when you have pigs at the trough who have been in a feeding frenzy so long that you can't get them away from the trough. So what you have to do is you have to put them in handcuffs and drag them away from the trough. And if they'll do that, history has shown that you can correct the problem with capitalism. Unfortunately, Obama does not have the right people around him to do that. And I don't blame Eric Holder, because Obama has the right to say, look, Eric, go out there and do your job. The problem is Eric recognizes what everybody else recognizes, and that is Obama has surrounded himself with the very people that should be in prison to some degree. And it's a very tough thing to overcome. It's unlikely to me that we're even going to overcome it the next 4 years if he's reelected. But the truth is, we know for many other reasons that he must be reelected. So it's a bit of a quagmire. Bob in Northville, are you there?
Yeah, how you doing, Mike?
I'm doing well, thanks.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that you're right on the money about the banksters and, you know, ripping off the American public and the home buyers and the investors that bought the loans. You know, they ripped off all sides. And also that Obama hasn't done enough to prosecute them. But I just wanted to add to that that Obama hasn't been that great. But Romney would be a thousand times worse. Because
Bob, there's no question. I don't doubt what you say at all. Understand. But it's not my place. It really isn't. I see these discussions from other places than simply sitting behind this microphone. I'm the guy that takes depositions of the CEOs of these folks that run Wall Street companies. I mean, several months ago, I was in Europe taking depositions of the Bear CEOs. And as I was taking the deposition of those Bear CEOs, Bear Industry, the people who make aspirin, I realized there's nothing to interrupt their feeding frenzy, you see. There's nothing I can hit them for punitive damages. I can take them to court. I can tell their story. But you have to understand, I've already been down that road. I handled the case against Bayer, where Bayer had a product called Factor 8. Factor 8 was for children who were hemophiliacs. And they were mostly young boys. They were all boys because that's how the hemophiliac is passed on. But they were given this drug. It's all an injection to help them with when they had an episode from the hemophilia. It was supposed to help them clot blood. Well, Bayer understood that the product had been infected with HIV. They said, well, we didn't know it was HIV. We knew it was something dangerous. We didn't know it was HIV, which was a ridiculous argument. But then after they were told to take the product off the market here, they shipped it all over the world. It was in the United States, thousands of people died. Child would go home. They would infect an entire family during that time because there was just no understanding about how you dealt with all this. So Bayer, it was taken off the market here, and then they'd ship it overseas, and more people died. Now this is so. Do I change the way they do business by fining them? Do I change the way they do business by hitting them for money? They don't really care about that. What they care about is when you show up and you put handcuffs on the CEO of the company, and then you say to the people who are injured, "Would you rather that person go to prison or you get money?" The people will always tell you, "I would rather that person go to prison." And you have to have a president, and you have to have an attorney general that understand that is the caliber of decency that they have to show when they're dealing with the common person versus corporate America. I'm Mike Papantonio, sitting in for Tom Hartman, 866-987-8466. Give me a call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'm Mike Papantonio, sitting in for Tom Hartman. Follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. Ring of Fire Radio. Let me know what you're thinking about. We'll be right back.
Oh,
back to Tom Hartman program. I'm Mike Papantonio, sitting in for Tom. You know, in spite of the fact that the private sector has added jobs for 28 consecutive months, I mean, that's the real story. Jobs, private sector jobs, 28 months, we've seen the increase. There's been still a massive unemployment problem in America that, frankly, President Obama has no control over. There's no other way to put it. Simple terms, he simply doesn't have control over this kind of unemployment. To make matters worse, states across the country have been slashing their unemployment programs in order to cushion the blow for the Great Recession, not saving money when they should and spending money when they shouldn't. Bryce Covert is the editor of the Roosevelt Institute. And I want to ask you, Bryce, let me ask you, at this point, what I'm seeing is states that don't even have money to pay for their unemployment crisis.
Exactly. What you were saying is that the states have not done a good job of saving up the money they need to spend on unemployment benefits in the bad times. Clearly, that's where we are right now. We have record levels of unemployment, and it's been at a pretty high level for a long time now, which obviously would mean a lot of people are looking to claim unemployment benefits to get them through to the next job. And unfortunately, right now, we're seeing a lot of cutbacks in those benefits, and a lot of it is because states are supposed to save up reserves and put them in a fund when times are good, when the economy is going well, so that they can spend that money on benefits when needed in the bad times. But states, a lot of states were tempted to not save up enough by either cutting the taxes that they used to collect that revenue or reducing how much employers were required to contribute. And now we're, you know, at a place where things have gotten pretty bad and we've run out of the money that we need.
Bryce, what we see happening is we understood what the austerity program really was, state by state. The austerity program really surfaced in states where you had Republican governors, Republican legislators, where everybody was scared to death that, golly, we have to start cutting public jobs. Well, that was really an excuse. If you went back and you took a look at the ALEC plan. The ALEC plan has been around for 15 years to figure out how you could go about getting rid of teachers, destroying public worker unions, ways that you can take the public worker and marginalize them. And so a state actually knew that they were going to do that. They knew that they were going to have unemployed numbers huge. In Florida alone, I think Rick Scott was able to fire 2,500 teachers. So there is that unemployment issue. But you're saying they never planned, they never even saved the money they were supposed to, that they were mandated to save for unemployment. Did I get that right?
Exactly. And what you're saying is very correct, that you know, states' budgets have definitely taken a beating in the recession, particularly when it first hit and so many were unemployed and not therefore paying taxes. But these decisions that a lot of these conservative states are making aren't actually forced. They are real choices. This unemployment benefits is one example. They made the choice in good times to cut taxes, and now we're feeling the ramifications when they can't pay out the benefits. And another choice that they're making, as you were pointing out, is to lay off public sector workers. Research that my colleague at the Roosevelt Institute, Mike Konfl, and I did showed that last year, 70% of those job losses happened in a handful of very conservative states. And those same states made the decision at the same time to either cut corporate taxes, cut taxes for the high income earners, or both. So you can see that while they may say that they're sort of up against the wall, there really are decisions being made here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this, and you know this story. I mean, ALEC has been, you know, the reason, for example, that Scott Walker picked the fight in Wisconsin was they thought they had a window, okay? The window was they were in charge of the governor's office. They were in charge of the legislature. So state by state, we knew way ahead that if they ever got there, that the first thing they were going to do was try to cut these government employees in order to accomplish what Grover Norquist had told him he wanted to accomplish, which was to shrink government to the point that it was so small that you could drown in a bathtub. So they had the window to do that. But the irony here is they knew it was coming. They knew they'd have all these unemployed, and they also knew that no matter what they did to curtail the system. I mean, they could cut the number of weeks that a person gets for unemployment. They could give drug testing. They could put all kinds of barriers up for things like seasonal workers. They knew they could do all that, but they still knew that they weren't going to have enough money. And right now, UF states simply don't have enough money to pay for this. Is that, did I get that right?
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing, too, is that now that we don't have enough money to be paying these benefits, they are not even looking at the revenue side of the equation. They're not tending to look at whether they should raise taxes or ask employers to contribute more. All of the solutions have focused on the employee, side or the out-of-work person side. Like you said, putting up barriers like drug testing or excluding seasonal workers, lowering how much they pay out, things like that, that's been the solution almost entirely. And in a time of high unemployment, that's not much of a solution.
Well, at this point, it's kind of checkmate for the worker because, the budgets have been driven by, A, cutting taxes for wealthy people, cutting taxes for corporations, and then cutting services that we used to assume we had. We used to think, for example, that we're going to have fire departments and police departments and teachers and that people were going to pick up the garbage. But under the Norquist plan, which is where all this started, Alec didn't just come up with this and then it didn't just move to the states kind of by accident. The plan was we have to have a Republican governor, we have to have a Republican legislature, and if you look at the 2010 cycle, they put everything into that. And so how do they pull out of this? What happens next? I mean, where does this cycle end as far as them? They got unemployed people. What do you have, about 360,000 people a week that are making new claims for unemployment? How are they going to deal with it when they don't have the money?
I think we have to look at the revenue side. I think we can't just focus on solutions that look at putting up barriers or lowering benefits. This should have been happening during the good times when the economy is booming. That's a good time to be having that revenue come in from taxes and from employer contributions. But if we ignore that now, then we're really not looking at the full range of options to get these unemployment benefits to the people that need them. And the other thing that's happening right now, which is a different issue, but it's related to unemployment, is that long-term or extended benefits are being cut right now as well. And that's just because the rules of the extended program say that if your unemployment rate hasn't deteriorated over recent years, then you have to cut off the funding, even though obviously things haven't really gotten much better, they also haven't gotten much worse. So we're seeing a bunch of states that are just having to cut off funding for these extra benefits that people clearly still need.
What are these people doing? I mean, what are they don't have a job. They get a letter, your benefits have been cut off. What's their next move? Move out of the house, live in a car? I mean, the reason I say that is we actually see that happening. I see public sector lawyers that are saying, yes, this is happening. Families of four that don't have a place to live anymore because of this Grover-Norquist chain domino effect that's taken place all the way to the states now.
And we've seen a lot of people either moving in with their parents or all living together in houses. I mean, we haven't seen a lot of new housing being developed. Part of that is because of the housing collapse, but part of that is because people are really sort of doubling up, tripling up, quadrupling up together and trying to make ends meet, finding income when they can. And it's tough. There's not a lot of safety net to fall back on anymore. It's been
well. Let me look at it another way, too. We got some quick time. What about the investor who buys the municipal bond? What about the investor who is looking at a state like Florida? And you say, I think I'm going to buy that school bond. I think I'm going to buy that bridge bond. And all of a sudden, we find that Rick Scott is driving Florida into a nosedive, a crash, a burn down. What does that do to the investor out there who says, hell no, I'm not buying Florida bonds. I'm not going to buy New York bonds or California bonds or wherever because I see that they don't have the financial stewardship to protect me when the bond entity goes under. The bridge entity can't pay for the bond. Isn't that another part of this problem that it's not something I know you're prepared to talk about, but I know you understand the connections here.
Sure. I mean, we've already seen municipal bankruptcies in California. I mean, those things are starting to happen. They're very real, and it is a concern. And look, these issues obviously affect unemployed workers, and it's really hard for them, but it affects all of us. It affects the entire economy. If we hadn't lost so many public sector workers, unemployment would probably be a percentage point lower than it is right now, which is huge. So these aren't made in isolation. This isn't just happening in a specific state. This isn't just happening to unemployed workers. It's infecting, like you're saying, investors in municipal bonds. It's affecting the entire economy.
We're seeing municipal bankruptcies, for example. We're going to talk about it tomorrow, municipal bankruptcies, because, gee, you wanted to give the millionaire more of a tax cut and not make up for that money anywhere else. Bryce Covert, thank you for joining me. I'm Mike Papantonio, sitting in for Tom Hartman, 866-987-8466. Join me. Give me a call. I'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Hartman. Follow me, would you please, at Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. Let me know what you're thinking about. I'll be back.
Every time I read the news, I'm always more confused.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom. Let's go to some of these callers. Rob in New Jersey. Rob, are you there?
Hi, Mark.
Thank you for holding, okay?
Mike?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I just want to point out that I love the beginning of your show, the quote from Jefferson and Lincoln. And I don't know if you knew this, but you brought two big ironies. One is Jefferson and Lincoln are both Republicans. Jefferson started the Democratic Republicans, changed the name to Republicans. Lincoln was Republican, so the two presidents you quoted who feared the corporations and the banks are
Republicans.
Part of the party that's today supporting them.
Yeah. Well, I think there's another great irony here. Every time, do you ever hear the Republicans talk about Lincoln? They always talk about Reagan. You know, Lincoln probably is the greatest president they ever had. And now, but they want to talk about Reagan, and there's probably reasons for that too, Rob, if you really explored it just a little bit more. But you're right. Both Lincoln and Jefferson at least understood what the risk was when you put all that money in the hands of bankers. And I don't know why it's taken us so long to figure that out. I don't know why we're still willing to take it. It just is beyond me. More importantly, I don't know why our administration is so willing to take it, other than the fact this is an election year, they need the money, but they've had 3 years to do something. And as I said, opening the program, nobody has been prosecuted, at least for the big meltdown that we knew was coming from derivatives and swaps and CDOs. And it's a little disheartening, and it makes me wonder, you know, as I've said so many times, Obama has to win. But if he wins, don't we have to send him a pretty clear message? Not again. You know, don't tell us that you're going to do this and then not do it again. That, I suppose, is my message. Don't tell us that you're going to get Wall Street under control and then not do this again. And I really am totally convinced, having practiced law from the standpoint of going toe-to-toe with these corporations for so many years, and in what I've learned in politics, is regulations won't work. You know, the only thing I found as a prosecutor, if you have a repeat criminal, if you have a criminal who does it again and again, like Citicorp or Bank of America or, Goldman Sachs, they can only pay so many fines, and they don't really care beyond that. And so the only thing you can do is show up at their house and put handcuffs on them, just like you would the mob. And I don't know why we can't get that in our head. This is the mob. And when we have our, attorney general stand up and, you know, he's got these prosecutors and police and all behind him, and he said, today we arrested three mobsters, Cosa Nostra mobsters. I would much rather see him say, today we arrested 20 people from Goldman Sachs, 10 people from J.P. Morgan. That would mean something. 15 people from Barclay. That is the only thing that's going to save democracy. And I am not even equivocal about this. It's not even a close call in my mind. That's the kind of aggressive attention this is going to take. Russ in Lafayette, Indiana. Russ, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
I'm glad you were talking about Lincoln there, because this summer I've been trying to follow the Lincoln Heritage Trail and go to all the three sites, the historic sites that Lincoln, that we have on Lincoln, and they're all grossly underfunded. They're beginning to get some age on them, and they're not putting anything else into them. Even within the tomb, right above Lincoln's head, there's plaster falling off the ceiling and right onto Mr. Lincoln's head, and it's just unbelievable.
Yeah.
And we all know, because he freed the blacks, that's why they're not holding up Mr. Lincoln as their hero, because him, I agree with you, him and Mr. Jefferson are personal heroes of mine, superheroes.
Well, that's part of it, but the other part is that we have an infrastructure that, in the most conservative estimation, is going to cost about $3 trillion to fix. We all hear about the bridges that collapse and somebody dies. We know those stories. We hear about them. But the stories we don't know about is an infrastructure where we have an energy grid that's not working, where we have sewage that's running into our drinking water, where we have roads that the government says are so dangerous that some of them aren't drivable, where we start looking like a banana republic because Grover Norquist has convinced a bunch of lame brain Republican senators that we can't spend money for our infrastructure. And when they fought Obama on the Jobs Act, what was it that President Obama wanted to do, Russ? He wanted to rebuild our infrastructure. He understood it would do many things. First of all, it would start making us look like a leader in the world. I was in China just 6-7 months ago, and when you compare what they're doing to their infrastructure compared to what we have over here, we look like a banana republic, to be quite frank with you. And so Obama wanted to say, we can put people to work. Pass my Jobs Act. You remember? Went all over the country, pass my Jobs Act. But the Republicans said, no, what we want to do is we want to be recalcitrant. We want to be obstructionist. We want to filibuster, because we believe that there's an advantage to having the public perceive a Congress that is in gridlock. The Republicans have analyzed this. They believe it inures a benefit to them when you have a Democratic president. So this has all been thought out, but the truth is President Obama has tried to do something about the infrastructure, the very thing that you're talking about. That's a small part of it. But $3 trillion at the very least is what it's going to take to get our infrastructure back to something we can be proud of. Travel to a third world country right now, and you'll understand that our infrastructure is not looking much different than you might see in those third world countries. But we have this idea of American exceptionalism. We have this idea that, golly, we're a superpower, aren't we? Aren't we a superpower? Take a trip to China. Take a look at what's happening over there, and you come back here and tell me that we're still in the competition. 866-987-8466. I'm Mike Papantonio. I'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Mike Papantonio, in for Tom Hartman. You know, when George Bush packed the various agencies, whether it's FDA, whether it's OSHA, whatever, the EPA, when he packed the agencies with his political hacks, what he was doing was packing the agencies with people that he understood weren't really going to regulate. They weren't going to look over anybody's shoulder and say, this is how you're supposed to do this. You're doing this wrong. There was no threat to these people, to industry at all. But one industry that got hit particularly hard was the FDA. the Food and Drug Administration was hit because he actually packed the Food and Drug Administration almost with his hand-picked cronies as a promise, as a way to keep a promise to the pharmaceutical industry, and that is, we're going to let you do what you want to do. And so now we have another drug. It's virtually almost every month that we hear the new story. What is the new drug that's killing our neighbors, that's killing our family members? This month it happens to be something called Pradaxa. I have Roger Denton and Ned McWilliams with me to talk about that topic. Guys, do you see the same story playing out here on Pradaxa, where you have an FDA that is dysfunctional, that's owned and operated by the industry?
Yeah, absolutely right, Pap. This is a situation where you've got bureaucrats overseeing the real doctors and the real scientists here. In this case of Pradaxa, the real scientists and the doctors who looked at the data, who looked at the evidence, they said this drug is not better than as you're touting it to be. It should not get the superiority claim, and that we have questions about the data. But it was the people in the suits who trumped the folks in the lab coats and let them go ahead and sell this drug to our parents and our grandparents as safe and effective, when in fact it's not.
Roger, you're in St. Louis. You've handled some of the biggest pharmaceutical cases probably in America out of St. Louis. I'm wondering, do you see the same pattern here with this case, where they've taken the clinicals, they've lied about the clinicals again, or they have minimized the importance of the clinicals, and they've told people take this drug and everything's going to be okay?
Yeah, Pap, absolutely. And what we're seeing as well is in this particular drug, Pradaxa.
Explain what Pradaxa does.
Well, Pradaxa is a blood thinner. It's used for treatment of various things, including folks with atrial fibrillation or AFib, and it's supposed to thin the blood in a therapeutic way to help prevent blood clots. But what it is doing is, first of all, it gets approved with no oversight, frankly, of what took place in Germany where it was developed. The FDA doesn't go over there. They don't pay any attention. So what gets submitted to the FDA is what the company chooses. And then what we start finding out, when it's on the market, it comes on the market in the fall of 2010, and in the first 6 months, there's over 500 serious adverse events, including 65 fatalities. It's amazing. In addition to all that, there's no antidote. So when these folks go to the hospital or the emergency rooms, they literally are bleeding to death, and emergency room doctors aren't able to handle it.
Okay, let me talk about that. Now, first of all, there were other blood thinners that are available. I mean, this wasn't even a drug we needed. Did I get that right?
Absolutely. Coumadin, that most folks have heard about, have been around for more than 50 years. And the safety profile is well known, and the doctors know how to treat people if they happen to have a complication. And there's a relatively simple way to reverse a problem if someone starts having an event. And yet, we don't need the drug. So the only reason we need this drug is some German company decides that they want to make a whole bunch of money in our country.
Well, don't we see that? Didn't you just, I mean, virtually, the reason I'm interviewing you is because, I mean, you are one of the key people in this country that handles these huge drug cases. Don't we see it time and time again? I don't know why it's just Europe lately.
Well,
I think I do. I think Europe has kind of made us into their third world testing ground. They send the product over here because they know that they can game the regulatory system. They can lie to our regulators. They can pay off lobbyists to accomplish anything they want. And so we end up being the experiment, the grand experiment, don't we?
Absolutely. There is absolutely no safety data to speak of done in the clinical work. And they essentially have the United States folks and folks around the world being their guinea pigs.
Ned, how many cases, what was the red flag? I mean, what was the clear red flag to the FDA that says, look, you know, we know, you know, you're being lied to? the gigs up. What kind of numbers did they start seeing early on?
Well, I mean, before the drug was even approved, the scientists that were looking at the data saying this, we don't believe this data. We find this incredible, and we just doubt the integrity of this data. But then even once it was approved, like Roger said, as soon as this drug was approved, within the first 12 weeks, I think there was over 500 cases of deaths reported to the FDA. And again, the problem is it's our FDA that's really slow to act, because if you look at this drug isn't just sold in the United States, it's sold around the world, but the FDA is lagging behind the rest of the world in terms of the way they're acting and what they're doing. If you look at Japan, if you look at the European Union, if you look at New Zealand, they're out there, they're warning doctors, they're warning users that you might bleed to death with this drug, but there's no such action taking place.
Roger, have you, in your experience doing this, have you seen that other countries are much quicker to take a drug off the market than the United States?
Well, absolutely. First of all, you know, when we look at these cases and these tragedies, we often look to the foreign regulators and foreign scientists because they seem to look into it with appropriate scrutiny, and they're always way ahead of the FDA. And then the other problem our country is once the FDA approves the drug, there's virtually no mechanism in place to have a drug brought off the market.
I can't even think of one. I really can't. Let me ask you, Roger, so they come out in the market and they say, we have a drug thinner, but we know there's other drug thinners out there. How did they sell this as one that was superior to the others?
Well, what they do is they have their own clinical trials with their own hand-picked folks, and they try to come up with a reason why it's more superior.
What was their reason? A lot of times it's monitoring, for example.
Well, they claim that on Coumadin that folks have to go visit the doctor on a regular basis to make sure their blood is appropriately in a therapeutic range. And their story here is, well, if you just take two pills a day, you never have to go visit your doctor.
In other words, Pradaxa. The Pradaxa people are telling the public ours is better because you don't have to be monitored. We don't have to check your blood level and make sure that you won't bleed to death if you have an episode of some kind. Is that right?
That's right. But what they did was they took perfectly healthy people who were doing fine on Coumadin. And one story that's just incredibly tragic, someone that we've looked at the medical records, a family, an elderly woman had been on Coumadin for almost 20 years without a problem. They switched her to Pradaxa based upon this marketing by this company. 2 days later, she's in an emergency room with a nosebleed. The doctors try to figure it out, put her on a dialysis machine to try to get the Pradaxa out of her blood. Units and units of blood, and within 48 hours, she's dead.
Oh, my God. Okay, guys, look, keep up. It's every week. It used to be you would see a story like this occasionally. Now the chickens have come home to roost. The Bush years have come home to roost. I'm Mike Papantonio, standing in for Tom Hartman today. Give me a call at 866-987-8466 or follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. Let me know what you're thinking. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm Mike Papantonio, standing in for Tom Hartman. Follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Mike Papantonio, in for Tom. This is a smart audience. What I'm always amazed about is how smart the progressive audience has become. I get this tweet from Dennis Ball, and he gets it right. He understands. If you were to explain what Dennis just put in this tweet, what he's saying is it's a nuance. It is when corporate America and the banksters make a promise, and that is give us your $800 billion, give us your bailout. And then we're going to take the money and put it back into the economy. We're going to create a robust economy. We all remember those words. Dennis remembered them. And what his point is in this tweet is, they knew exactly what they were doing when they started holding that money, storing $3 to $4 trillion up so they could stop this economy. So we could have a guy like the Mitster in control, and they could break the law. They could steal from us. They could create scam after scam. They could get away with it. And so Dennis's point is they have an interest in holding the money. And that's what they're doing. We've talked about that on many programs, but sometimes people miss those nuances. And I'm always, always impressed with how well-informed the progressive audience is. Let's go to Mike in Lafayette. Mike, you there?
Hello?
How are you, Mike?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you. Go ahead.
I was just listening to your talking about the FDA, and I've worked in the pharmaceutical industry for 15 years, and I'm pretty alarmed at, you know, the current state of affairs and the push for deregulation and less regulation and oversight. And the argument is always that the market would correct itself because, you know, companies aren't going to want to sell something that, you know, kills people, but yet they are not correcting themselves now. So how are we going to have a better, you know, oversight of
right. Mike, your point is great. Your point is great. The way this was sold, I'm very familiar with hearings. The hearings was, if you deregulate the industry, the pharmaceutical industry, for example, deregulate, the market will have somebody going out buying a better product. Not really. They don't even understand. The average person doesn't understand what in the world they're buying. The doctor many times doesn't even have all the real clinical information on what he's giving his patient because so much of that is hidden from the doctor on purpose. So this free market idea, especially in something like pharmaceuticals, is absurd. And, you know, the truth is something like Pradaxa. If you were just to take Pradaxa, the story we just heard, they came onto the market. They told people, buy Pradaxa because you won't have to go out and be monitored. It's a blood thinner. You don't have to be monitored. But they didn't tell them, we have case after case where people bleed to death with minor injuries. We can't stop the bleeding. It's impossible for us to stop the bleeding. And people bleed out right on the emergency room bed. And those stories are never told. So the market doesn't take care of itself. Who even knows that story? If you're listening to this program, you might know this story. If you listen to Ring of Fire, we do these kinds of programs all the time. You might know that story. But the truth is, the market doesn't take care of itself when the market is wholly corrupt. All the market does is a company like the folks that make Pradaxa, they say, if we sell X number of years of Pradaxa, we're going to make $10 billion. And in the end, we may have to pay out $1 billion or $2 billion. So we're still $8 billion ahead. That's how they think. Let me go to Lee in East Brunswick, New Jersey. Lee?
Hi, Dr. Mike. I just wanted to call as a patient and as a firm believer in medical regulation, because there's obviously no way that medicine can be a free market because nobody knows anything other than the doctors and the researchers. But I do want to correct one statement of your guest a few minutes ago. The comment was made that Coumadin is a safe drug. It's been used for 18 years, and it's really no big deal to be.
Well, he said it was safer. Yeah, he doesn't think it's safe. He thinks it's safer.
Well, as a 10-year patient with 2 or 3 transfusions to my credit, and every 3 to 4 weeks visit to the doctor where I have to get my arm stuck,
right,
and lots of black blue marks, it is not an easy drug.
No, it's not.
So, but I'm not trying to. You don't feel sorry for me, but the point is that there is a need for a better anticoagulant.
Well, it's not Pradaxa. That's the point. The point is it's not Pradaxa. You see, now they're going to go to where they're going to have to monitor, but that's after they've killed thousands of people, you see. Now, the only thing, what I heard was they're saying Pradaxa was a drug, and you could sell it and tell the patient, gee whiz, Ms. Jones, you know, you don't have to monitor with this. You don't have to go get stuck in certain periods and find out what the blood levels are of this anticoagulant. And they were selling people that, and they were lying to them, Lee. That's the problem. They were lying to them. And they can lie and make $8 billion. Given the choice, they're always going to lie. I hate to sound like such a fatalist, but I have been wrestling with these people for 30 years, whether it's Dow Chemical, Exxon, Wall Street, Goldman Sachs, Bayer, you name it. It's a mentality that we can't even get our arms around most of the time. That when I open a case in front of a jury, the jury doesn't want to acknowledge that corporations do this kind of thing in America. It's too ugly for them to even comprehend. They want to put their head in the sand and say, that can't be. Surely I'm safer than that. And you'll see a defense lawyer for a pharmaceutical company play that up. They'll play it up and they will try to appeal to that denial. Because we have to be realists about it. And if I sound like I say this with conviction, I do. It is a mismatch. The average person, where it comes to confronting a company, whether it's Pfizer or Merck or any of these pharmaceutical companies, it is a mismatch. The chances of prevailing against them are so slim. And it is because the average person out there wants to believe that surely corporate America has not grown to be that evil. They have. That's the bad news. 866-987-8466. I'm Mike Papantonio, in for Tom Hartman. Give me a call.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I'm Mike Papantonio. I'll be back with Nancy Cohen and talk about the right-wing attack on women. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Show. I'm Mike Papantonio, sitting in for Tom. You know, I'll tell you, for months, the GOP has been waging this war against women. That's the only way you can describe it. Whether it is they want them to have less pay, whether they want to tell them what they can do with their body, it's all about a war on women. There's no other way to describe it. The Republicans are trying to run away from that. They're trying to even the playing field a little bit. But you know what? It really doesn't work that easily. It's hard to turn that image around. That's why women voters, just almost across the board, are favoring Obama. I think it's a very difficult thing for them to turn around. They're trying to do it. I have Nancy Cohen, the author of the book Delirium, The Politics of Sex in America. Nancy, what is the short list? I mean, I'm trying to recall it all, but it just seems to me it was, first of all, we want to tell you what to do with your body. Then we want to tell you that you need to be paid 23% less than a man working in the same job. Then we want to take your health care away. It was endless. I mean,
it is endless, and I don't think we have enough time today to go through the whole list.
Right.
But this week, it's the war on birth control. That's
okay.
Back.
Okay.
And mark my words, Romney is going to lose on the socialist issues. He's going to lose women. He's going to lose the election because he keeps going there.
Why? But why? I mean, is the guy? I mean, look, I don't mean this in a rhetorical way. I think he's adult. Yes, he is adult. He has a Harvard education, but he got him because of daddy. But he's adult. And how can? But even adult can see this coming. It's a train wreck with women voters.
You know, that is exactly the right question, is why did he go there again? And there are two reasons. One is he has no choice because the extremists are running the show. Rolling back women's rights is not a sideshow in the GOP. It's the main attraction.
Yeah.
The main attraction for the religious right, the sexual fundamentalists, the anti-women extremists who make up the majority of Republican voters.
And that you're saying that's the clown show that the Republicans have become. But the point is, I see Ann Coulter today coming out. Obama base is made up of stupid single women. That's her.
Yeah.
That's her. They're made up of stupid. She's calling women who vote for Obama stupid single women. So obviously they're tripling.
She's a rocket scientist.
Yeah, she is. She's the one that said that Timothy McVeigh, she wished that he would have bombed the New York Times building, that right there in the middle of New York. But at any rate, they're obviously tripling down on it, Nancy. And I'm not a genius. I'm a pretty decent strategist. I don't see the strategy here.
Well, the two reasons. It's that this is what Republican voters want. So Romney can't run away from it. The second thing, and I actually think this is more important, is that Mitt is no moderate. He himself is a militant Mormon who's totally at home with keeping women down. You look at what he did as governor of Massachusetts, where he vetoed legislation to provide emergency contraception to rape victims. You look what he did when he was a bishop of the Mormon Church, when he tried to coerce a single woman to give up her child for adoption because he didn't think it was right for single women to parent their own children. On and on the list can go on what Mitt himself is truly about.
Well, I mean, every time, look, Lilly Ledbetter Fair Play Act. I mean, that's where we're just, look, a woman can file a discrimination case if it's clear that she's being discriminated with pay. I mean, you know, we ought to be able to do that. But here you have a guy running for president that probably doesn't think you ought to do that. Then you have, then you have the Blunt Rubio amendment that is defeated. Okay, so it's defeated. He doesn't have to support it, but he still comes out and supports it even after it's defeated. And in that, I mean, you talk about a horrible amendment.
Right, and he said that he's going to either abolish the contraception mandate or reinstate something like the Blunt-Rubio Amendment.
Which would do what? Give us a quick on the Blunt-Rubio.
Well, what that would do, it would give any employer basically veto power over your reproductive health care. It would allow employers to say, we're not going to cover birth control because we think birth control is wrong. I mean, Arizona had a doozy of this type of law where they would have allowed employers to look at women's birth control prescriptions to see what they were using birth control for, and the legislation was written in a way that they could have fired women just for having sex if they weren't married.
Okay. Because, well, they are crazy. Look, we had an interview earlier with a man who had come from he had been a Republican operative. I mean, he'd been a staff for Congress, Republican Congress. And he comes away and he says, you know, it was too crazy for me because the religious right is now in charge of the party. It is the Taliban party. It is the teabagger Taliban party. So your point, Nancy, what I'm hearing you say is exactly what he said, is that is the grown-ups have lost control of the party. It is like a scene out of Home Alone. So you have these crazy religious fanatics that I'm surrounded with, God Almighty, where I live, they're all around me. You know, there's a Southern Baptist church on every other corner. And this is their dialogue. This is their goal, to unseat Obama so we can create this theocracy. I don't know how else to put it.
Yeah, I think theocracy is the right way to think about it. They're anti-women extremists. They're anti-gay extremists. They're certainly un-American in the way that they want to impose their religious beliefs on everybody else. And it's really dangerous. Now, I think the more that the Democrats keep this message in the forefront, the better the party has a chance of doing. And I'm really impressed that Obama and the Obama campaign and many of the, you know, Senate and House campaigns aren't running scared.
No, they're not. And the last thing they should do is run scared. I pray that the Democrats are finally over running scared from every damn thing. I pray that every day. I'm encouraged. You know, Reed encourages me. Harry, thank goodness.
Wrote the this week.
Yeah. Okay. So look, let me cut to something else here. You've got, you have Mitt Romney saying, here is why you should vote for me as your guy, women, because I want the economy to become better. And if the economy gets better, things get better for you. But what he doesn't do is finish the sentence. And the rest of the sentence is, I want to continue cutting public employees. And women, of course, are the largest group of public employees. I forgot. I think it's two out of three women or something.
Yeah, I believe that's the number.
It's
you know,
a startling number.
That, his support for the Paul Ryan budget would throw about 18 million women off of Medicaid. Overturning the Affordable Care Act would mean that 17 million uninsured women don't get health insurance. And, of course, Medicaid is not going to be there anymore to take care of it. The Republican Party denies that there's a gender wage gap. Romney will not talk.
I mean, he knows the numbers. I mean, it's not. It's the GAO saying 23%. A woman makes 23% less than a man with less benefits, doing exactly the same job most of the time, more competently than the man that's working right next to her.
Exactly. That was exactly what happened to Lily Ledbetter, who had no idea what all the men around her were making.
Yeah.
So much more than her, until someone kind of broke the house rules and slipped her an anonymous note.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so a woman who knows these facts, it's a tough question. A woman who knows these facts, look, Ms. Jones, let me show you the facts. Here they are. You know, from a workplace, it's a disaster. From a health standpoint, it's a disaster. From your choice to be able to do with what you want to be able to do with your body, it's a disaster. Now, tell me why it is you want to vote for Mitt Romney. What is the reason? Please tell me the reason, Nancy.
Well, that is a good question, because what we forget is that at least half and more of the religious right is made up of fundamentalist women. Fundamentalist women, Mormon women,
right,
ultra-Catholic,
right, right,
Orthodox women.
Right.
And it was the women who actually got things rolling on this crazy anti-woman war.
Well, Phyllis Schlafly. I mean, you know the story.
Phyllis Schlafly and a lot of very, you know, unknown women who joined her to defeat the Equal Rights Amendment, to get sex education out of the schools, to take civil rights away from gays.
That was the DeVos woman who that comes from the door to door Amway, the Amway heiress. What? Why does she have a fight in things like that? What? She just doesn't have anything to do, or what? What is that about? Do you know the story behind that?
Well, I don't know her particularly, but for a lot of these women, they really believe the fundamentalist religious line that women should be submissive to men. That is the way God intended it. I mean, Michelle Bachmann said this, you know, on videotape not a couple years ago, that God commanded her to be a tax attorney. Her husband told her to be a tax attorney, and God said women should be submissive to their husbands, so therefore she became a tax attorney.
Mm.
You know, that wasn't in 1950 that she said that. That was in 2005 that she said that.
Yeah. So, Nancy.
And there are millions of fundamentalist women in the country. Now, they're a minority, but they're the ones that Mitt calls on to stand up next to him and say,
they just have more time on their hands? Maybe that's what it is, Nancy. They have more time on their hands. They can go knocking on doors for Mitt. If I'm a woman with children, you know what I'm afraid of Mitt? I see a mushroom cloud behind his head. I see Mitt getting us into a nuclear war. And if I got children, I'm a soccer mom, that ought to scare the hell out of you. 866-987-8466. Nancy, thanks for joining me, okay?
Thank you.
I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Hartman. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Hartman. Follow me on Twitter. Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. Let me know what you're thinking. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Show. I'm Mike Papantonio, sitting in for Tom Hartman. Let's go to these callers. Beverly in California. You there? Beverly? In California. Okay. Well, let's go to Garrett in Portland. You there?
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you.
I was listening to the show about the corruption business today, and especially the drug companies. And it seems every year we have a new record drug company fine. For example, in 2009, it was Pfizer with $2.9 billion, and a few weeks ago, GSK with the $3 billion.
Yeah, it's almost like they have meetings to say, well, we got the biggest fine this year. You know, we killed the most people. We made the most money, got the biggest fine.
Well, yeah, nobody's going to jail, and, you know, it just gets passed on. They just pass that fine on to the,
sure,
you know, to the people who are taking the drugs. The taxpayers end up paying that $3 billion fine.
Well,
they can do that.
But what are the alternatives? Don't fine them. Don't throw them in jail. Business as usual.
You know,
I mean,
it would surprise me if they started to try calling for tort reform, like to don't fix the problem, just stop the lawsuit.
Oh yeah, immunity. Well, they do that every year, Garrick. I'm president of the National Trial Lawyers Association. I mean, that's what I do. That's what I confront all the time. Let's have tort reform where we get immunity. And what's so remarkable is you'll walk into a courtroom sometimes and you're picking a jury and you'll say, well, what do you think about people's rights to bring a lawsuit like this? And they say, oh, no, people shouldn't be able to sue corporations, because the U.S. Chamber of Commerce spent about $60 million a year trying to convince people that we shouldn't sue a company that kills people. We shouldn't sue a GSK when they kill people. We shouldn't have to sue a company that kills people with bad products. At the same time, if you ask them, well, should they be arrested? Well, I don't know whether they ought to be arrested. Well, what do you do? I mean, what's the alternative? That you either take their money or you put them in handcuffs. And most people who I represent, I usually try cases, not individual cases, but I try cases for groups of people all over the country to test the case, to find out, okay, this is a case, I want to test the case and find out what jurors think about it. It's a test case process. And most of the people who I try cases for would say, I would much rather see the people who made these terrible decisions go to prison. And all of us would. I would prefer to see that. There's plenty of stuff for attorneys to do. We would much rather see these people put in handcuffs and go to prison. But instead, all we're able to do is punish them by taking money from them. Unfortunately, that's not even punishment. There's no punishment there. A company figures out exactly how many products they're going to sell, and then they compute how many people they back into that and figure out how many people they can kill from there. Bradley in Washburn, are you there?
Yes, and thank you for taking my call. I want to just compliment you because you really have a lot of good insight and a lot of common sense. To all these right-wingers out there that don't understand what's happening, just look at the greed that's in the world and in our country in particular. And 1 Timothy chapter 6 is a great chapter to go into, is for the love of money. Yes. And that's exactly what's happening. And another thought, I've not seen the word conservative in the scriptures. If somebody could find that for me, I would appreciate it.
Yeah. Bradley, you know, an interesting thing. It is... It's not the love. It's not money's the root. It is the love of money is the root. It gets to where the point to where, like we said yesterday, how many homes does a guy like Mitt Romney have to have? I mean, we've lost count. How many square feet does he need in that home to where he says, okay, I have a good self-image now. I can be happy with myself. My family can be happy with me. I'm happy now. At some point, it just simply, you get Trumpedized. I mean, Donald Trumpedized to where you lose sight of everything that's decent. You lose sight of humanity. And that's what's happened, unfortunately, on Wall Street. That's what's happened with corporate America. They've lost sight of humanity. And you can't regulate that away. That's been my point to this program. There's no regulation you can do to change the heart and mind of these people. The only thing you can do is throw them in prison. And then the people who come after them say, oh, you know, you heard about Joe. Joe went to prison for 10 years. So when you make this next decision, understand you can go to prison for 10 years, too. I hate that we have to reduce it to that. And I'd love to tell you that regulations in the end can work, but I just have to tell you, I don't think they can. Mark in West Virginia, you there?
Hey, Pap, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you.
I really enjoy your show. Yeah, I was just sort of calling up to comment on a couple of things you said over the past couple of days, and I agree with you, you know, like trying to talk some of these people out of their position. I don't understand why they hang on to it. I'm often reminded of people who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it, and I see this constantly. I was saying something to the guy to answer the call, you know, that it seems like there is a cyclical system here. You get the Republicans in, and they.
Okay, Mark, you broke up. Let me pick up with where you left off. I just an interesting thing. I remember trying a case in West Virginia one time, picking a jury up there. It was against DuPont. DuPont had gone into an area. It was called Spelter there in West Virginia. It was a community of Spelter. And what they had done is they had polluted the water and polluted the air and the land so badly that they were poisoning people. But still, people in that town felt like they had some kinship with DuPont. And there's some real tragedy to that. It's taken a long time for Americans to get to that weird point. Well, look, thanks to all my guests. I'm Mike Papantonio. It's been fun sitting in for Tom. I'll be back tomorrow. And as Tom would say, get out there, get active, occupy something, tag, you're it. I'm Mike Papantonio in for Tom Hartman. Follow me on Twitter at Ring of Fire Radio. I want to know what you think. Thanks a lot.
Listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.